From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We are joined at the top of this hour by the superintendent of the Los Angeles Unified School District, the country's second largest, which has just announced it will stay online when school starts again this fall. And Superintendent Austin Buettner, welcome. And for those people, including the president, who believe you're making the wrong decision, can you explain why you're doing this?
It's the science. It's the health and safety in all the school community. And like every school district, we balance three sometimes conflicting objectives: the learning needs of students, the impact the virus is having on working families, and the health and safety of all in the school community. And if you look at the skyrocketing rates of the virus in our community, you look at the rate twice the World Health Organization guidelines of positivity on tests, and you look at studies in Italy which show half the people in a quarantine town showed no symptoms when they were tested positive for the virus. You put all those three things together and say we can't be safely back at schools now. Our goal is to get back as soon as possible, but health and safety first.
Well, when the president says, for example, that if Walmarts can be open, then why can't schools? What do you say?
Yeah, I'm not responsible for Walmart. I'm responsible for the health and safety of all in the school community. And schools are different than Walmarts. We have young children in small rooms with vulnerable adults. We are a petri dish. It's not a 10-year-old in isolation. It's a 10-year-old with a 30-year-old teacher and a 50-year-old bus driver who goes home to a 7-year-old grandmother. And until the virus in our community is at a lesser level, below World Health Organization guidelines, it's just not safe.
You mentioned working families. What about students in your schools who have parents who are essential workers and have to go to work to make money to put food on the table? What are they supposed to do if their kids are now going to be at home?
Schools are the center of the community, and many of the challenges communities face present themselves in schools. More than 80% of the families we serve live below the poverty line. We know from surveys more than half have someone in the family who's lost work.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can't be back at school safely, we as an entire community, cities, counties, states, employers have to find a way to provide that margin of safety and child care if appropriate. We're not a relief organization for everything that ails society. Our primary mission is to educate kids and do so safely.
Could you envision a situation where students come back into the schools in October or November or December if things get notably better by then?
Absolutely. We want to be back as soon as possible. We all recognize the best learning happens in a school setting. We understand the needs for families to have some sense of normalcy in their lives, but we can't just wave a wand and make it happen. And the piece that we should be talking about is the testing and the contact tracing, because the communities around the world who've done it right are doing that. And we think schools are the place to do it because we have cohorts. We have the same defined group of people every day. We can adequately and properly trace, and we go outside that first concentric circle and reach out to families. They'll take our phone call. We're trusted.
What do you make of the fact that your neighbors in Orange County, leaders there, came to a very different conclusion and just voted to allow schools to reopen without even the mandatory use of masks or increased social distancing in classrooms?
I struggle to see how that group of leaders passed a 10th grade science class. We've looked at the science. We've had experts from UCLA and around the nation on what the science says. Now, maybe they've got different science in Orange County. They'll be running a giant experiment with children and adults, putting their lives at risk. And if it proves successful, we'll be delighted to follow in their footsteps. If they're putting people at risk, as we believe, they're making a big mistake.
Are you worried that you're going to lose federal funding because President Trump and his education secretary have threatened to withhold federal funding for schools that don't reopen?
Not in the slightest bit.
Why not?
The will of Congress and the intention of elected officials is to make sure that the funds go to students who need it. We run a public education system. I don't think, despite the rhetoric, we're going to be in a position where funds are cut off from schools or forcing schools to bring children and adults back in a place that's not safe.
Speaking of funds, do you have the funds you need to make sure that your students who are going to be learning remotely have access to laptops and the internet and the things that they'll need to study online?
I wish, Jeremy, you and I could take this conversation in the halls of Congress and ask those who think we can just go right back to school and bring them into this conversation. We suffer from a lack of adequacy of funding. We did before the pandemic. And one of the symptoms one would have seen is the lack of technology and tools to go immediately online. We found a way. We provided computers to all 500,000 students. We provided free internet access to those who need it. It costs money. It's going to continue to do so. And if the federal government wants students learning, provide the funds for the devices and the connectivity. Provide the funds for testing and tracing. And my hope is the next round of stimulus relief really focuses on the most important federal role, which is to provide the funding so we can do what we need to do in schools.
That is Los Angeles Unified School District Superintendent Austin Buettner. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
And I misspoke a moment ago. It was Florida's governor, not President Trump, who said if you can open Walmart, you can open schools.
Today marks the fifth anniversary of the Iran nuclear agreement. The deal gave Tehran relief from sanctions in exchange for limits on its program. But President Trump pulled the U.S. out in 2018 and reimposed sanctions, which have crippled Iran's economy. Lise Doucette joins us now on Skype. She's the BBC's chief international correspondent. And Lise, you were in Vienna when the agreement was reached back in 2015. But 5 years later, it seems that all of the promise of that day is lost. Is this deal dead?
It really was an historic day. And everyone knew on that day that there would be setbacks, that there were opponents in Washington and there were opponents in Tehran. But no one would have imagined what the situation is today. For many months now, in fact, since President Trump pulled out of the deal in 2018, describing it as the worst deal ever, with every month that has passed, the deal has been described as hanging by a thread. It is all but dead now. And not just that, Iran has now started moving away from the agreement in terms of enriching uranium, all very incremental and calibrated, but it is pushing back against the sanctions that the United States continues to impose on Iran.
What you're telling us, does this indicate that Iran is closer to developing a nuclear weapon than it was in 2015?
There was a phrase that was used in 2015, which was called the breakout time. That is the amount of time it would take Iran, if Iran broke away from the agreement, to produce a nuclear weapon. The deal achieved a breakout time of about a year. It is now said that the breakout time is closer to around 6 months, but Iran is still not enriching uranium to the percentage that would be required to make a bomb. And it is always said and continues to say that it is not interested in producing nuclear weapons. But it has to be emphasized that Iran is playing a very strategic game. It knows it cannot afford to lose its other allies, the European countries, Russia and China, who are still trying to keep this deal alive. So it is trying to stay as much as it can within the agreement. But it is also saying that it has no other choice. It's under huge pressure at home from the hardliners who never trusted this deal to basically push back and, in effect, put pressure on the Europeans in particular to say, if you don't save this deal, we're going to be out of it, not just out of this, but possibly the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. So calibrated steps, but steps all the same.
President Trump has talked about renegotiating this deal. So has his biggest rival, Joe Biden, if he were elected president. You actually interviewed Iran's foreign minister. What were some insights regarding Iran and the government having an appetite for renegotiating the agreement?
I think what has happened since 2018 has only confirmed the suspicions of those in the Islamic Republic, including the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who have never trusted the United States, who gave the go-ahead to President Rouhani to say, go ahead and do a deal with the United States. We don't trust them, but let's see what you can do. And Javad Zarif was heckled in the Iranian parliament, which is now dominated by conservatives again, saying that he sold out to the Americans. And he now says that why would they negotiate another deal when they've already negotiated? Well, it wasn't a perfect deal. President Obama was explicit. This is not a deal based on trust. It is a deal based on inspections, on implementation. And we had a statement from the EU foreign policy chief today, Josep Borrell, who again affirmed that this was the best tool possible for the international community to restrain Iran's nuclear program with an unprecedented level of inspection of Iran's nuclear installations.
I want to ask you about one more thing. President Trump, he focuses a lot of his criticism on Iran and China. Over the weekend, there was a story in the New York Times about a potential economic and military deal between those two countries. Is this U.S. effort to isolate Iran backfiring, thinking about China's role in allegiance with Iran?
Well, Iran needs power, needs partners, and more crucially, it needs countries to buy its oil. So Iran has to look somewhere else to allow it to weather this storm. They're all, of course, looking at what happens in the November presidential elections, but that's still a few months away.
That's Lise Doucette. She's the BBC's chief international correspondent. Lise, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now. Where independent minds get their start.
More than a million people in the U.S. have recovered from COVID-19, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. But even those who have gotten through the disease's initial effects can have lingering symptoms. We're going to check in now with two people who have contracted the coronavirus, Krista Thibodeau in New Braunfels, Texas, and Jennifer Dunlap in Columbus, Georgia. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, you've both had very different experiences with COVID-19. Jennifer, let me start with you. You only had mild symptoms. What was your experience with the disease like?
So after a known exposure, I started to just make sure that I was paying attention, you know, to anything that I felt was a little different in my body. About 4 days later, I started feeling like these little pinches kind of throughout my body, which was almost like a nerve going off. Like it kind of felt like a little stabbing feeling. And it might be in my elbow, in my head, in my leg, just all different places in my body. And the next morning, I woke up and I had stomach issues and had to go to the bathroom, which was a little bit unusual. And then I had like a burning sensation in my back that increased into the night. And kind of felt like icy hot was all over my back. Huh. And that would be probably the worst that it got was that second day.
But no cough, no fever?
No, no cough. Didn't cough one time, haven't coughed one time, no fever, and nothing else.
And when did you decide to go get tested?
So I got tested because we all had we had a known exposure, which came from my office. Everybody in my office, we all decided this was maybe on a Friday. We all decided that Monday we would go get tested. So I had previously ordered a test from LabCorp. And so I had one at home. And I also did a test at CVS, at the drive-through testing in CVS. Mm. You do that one yourself in your car. So I did those two tests the same day.
And I assume both of your tests came back positive.
Well, actually, both of those tests came back negative. So both of those came back negative. The person who we had the known exposure with, that person's test also came back negative. She tested that Monday before the Tuesday that I tested. And then we ended up testing again that next week. Her symptoms increased. And by the way, she didn't quarantine because she got a negative test result. Mm-hmm. But I did quarantine because I knew what I was feeling.
And it came back positive.
Yeah. And that's where the positive test results came
from.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's turn to Krista in New Braunfels, Texas. Krista, you first tested positive back in early April and you ended up in the hospital. Tell us what your experience with COVID-19 was like at first.
Well, I started with one of the classic symptoms. I had a headache and I had shortness of breath. I've never been prone to headaches, but this was one of the strongest headaches that I've ever had in my life. In fact, I still have the headache. It's been 112 days, and I'm still suffering from that same headache. and I had the shortness of breath, which is what took me into the urgent care. And I was diagnosed with bilateral pneumonia, and that took me into the hospital. I was transferred to another hospital in San Antonio, where I spent the most of the time there. And then thankfully, I was released 5 days later. I had the coughing. I had the digestive issues. So I had a lot of the classic COVID issues.
And you had a fever.
I had a fever. I had a high fever, especially in the hospital. I didn't have a fever going into urgent care, but once I got into the hospital that night is when my fever really spiked. It was 102 and then 103, 104 over the stay in the hospital. So it spiked really high once I was in the hospital.
And the only lingering symptom for you at this point, months later, is a headache?
Months later is the headache, 112 days with the headache.
Wow. And what do doctors think is the reason for that?
I've had two MRIs. I had a spinal tap this past week, and I've got an appointment with my neurologist to follow up on that this week. We're looking at intracranial hypertension is what they're thinking it might be caused by the virus. Because the virus is so new, a lot of the doctors are still learning as they go. But I've seen a lot of information on the neurological side of what's happening with this virus and how it's infecting the brain, especially with inflammation and things like that.
And do doctors believe that you are still contagious or that you have been for a lot of this time?
No, definitely not contagious. But it did take me about 6 weeks to test negative. I tested positive first April 3rd and didn't test negative until May the 12th.
And did you quarantine that whole time?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we were mandated by the county and we took it very seriously.
I wonder one other thing, which is when you go into the doctor for follow-up appointments to deal with this, you know, usually now when you go into a hospital, they take your temperature, they ask you all these questions. I assume when you say, yes, I did have COVID-19, and yes, I have had these symptoms, what is that like?
To be honest with you, it's a little bit disheartening. This past visit to the neurologist, I literally had the nurse grab her items and leave as if I had the plague. It was upsetting. Some people are compassionate, some are not. So it's been a mixed bag of results or reactions, I should say. It's been hard.
I wonder how each of you feel having had these experiences about the debate that is going on in this country right now about how severe the lockdown should be, how much people should require that masks are worn everywhere. I'll start with you, Krista. What do you think about what everybody's talking about right now?
I wish that people would respect one another. I know for me and my family, it's left an indelible mark, especially on me and my health. And I wish people would take it seriously. It's not a hoax. It's not a joke. It's not just a meme. It has taken the lives of many people, and it needs to be taken seriously.
Jennifer?
I agree with that. I found at the beginning, I had no idea of how things were going to develop for me. And so I experienced a lot of fear and anxiety. And so I was able to, you know, then go and find online groups where people were talking more about their experiences. And that's when I feel like I really learned how bad it could be for people. And then also, I mean, it hasn't been pleasant even having a mild case. I thank God that I did have almost no symptoms, but at the same time, I haven't seen my family. I still haven't seen my family. I have three sons and a husband, and I've been by myself. I'm still waiting on a negative test result. I just tested again yesterday to see if that was going to give me a negative test result, because I absolutely would feel terrible if anyone else in my family or my circle were to experience this, even if they had a mild case. I wouldn't want that at all for my loved ones. So that's been unpleasant also. And I don't think people grasp that either. There's the other aspects of it, even if it's just something small to one person, you still can't be around the people that you love and move about, you know, life freely.
There are big questions about whether people who have already had the virus are immune from it or how long they're immune from it. And doctors don't really know yet. Do each of you think that you are immune from getting it again? Krista, do you think so?
I'm still afraid. I've not stepped foot in a store in a public place since, you know, the beginning of March. I don't think I'm immune. I wouldn't dare to imagine that I am.
And Jennifer?
Well, I think there's a period of immunity, but I feel kind of like, you know, for the next 2 weeks, as a matter of fact, I just made a dental appointment for all the things I wasn't doing before that I need to go ahead and do. I'm really trying to just get those things in this next 2 weeks. And yeah, of course, I'm still by myself right now. Mm-hmm. And then after that point, no, I don't believe I'll have immunity that I would feel certain about. And, you know, we're taking all precautions at my office and at my home.
Let me just finally ask you one other thing, because, you're both from populations that are disproportionately affected by COVID-19. Jennifer, you're African-American, and Krista, you're Latina. I wonder how each of you feel about that aspect of this. Jennifer, I'll start with you.
Well, I feel like here locally with the African-American population, there is, it seems to me, people don't really believe what's happening. It's like they almost have to have someone close to tell them, like, this is real and this is really happening. Someone who they know has to go through something terrible with it in order for to really understand. And so that's been tough. And I don't know if that's just a general mistrust of mainstream media, or maybe the sources that people are accessing are different, around the country.
And what about you, Krista?
We're all members of the human race, and if they're not going to listen, they're not going to listen. You know, it's disheartening.
Do you think that members of the Hispanic community, though, where you are in Texas, are believing in how serious this disease is?
I don't think they are.
Well, I wish you both the best of luck, especially you, Krista, because it sounds like you have just been having these headaches for so long, and I hope that those go away very soon. And Jennifer, I hope you have continued success in not having any more symptoms from COVID-19. But I appreciate both of your time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jennifer Dunlap in Columbus, Georgia, and Krista Thibodeau in New Braunfels, Texas, each sharing their very different experiences with the coronavirus. Well, have you recovered from COVID-19? Let us know what you've been dealing with if you've had the virus at hereandnow.org. Shares of Tesla are electric. The company's stock price has quadrupled this year after posting several profitable quarters in a row, even as demand has dropped during the pandemic. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure on member station VPM. Robin, what is going on? Why are investors so in love with Tesla recently?
And the old story is that it's far and away the leader in the shift away from the internal combustion engine. I mean, you look at battery range, the bells and whistles, to actually producing a mass market sedan that is not just best in the EV class, but one of the best selling across the board in the United States, and doing this during an economic calamity. So even though it doesn't do the volume nearly of what a GM or a Toyota does, people are paying up for what the future might look like.
But quadrupling the share price in just a matter of months?
Yeah, look, there's... This is an exciting time for the shift away from things. And, you know, as we're going to discuss, there's a tremendous amount of speculation. People are wondering, are short sellers going to be smoked out of the story? Is the CEO going to say something? Is it going to be added to the S&P 500? So in addition to the fundamentals of the story, there's a tremendous amount of underlying gambling.
Well, speaking of the CEO saying something, we remember that Elon Musk had tweeted, what was that, like a year ago, that he was going to take it private at $420 a share. Well, that was when it was lower than that. Now it's like $1,500 a share or something like that for Tesla. They have had a few quarters of profitability, almost a full year. Would it be a big deal if Tesla got to be profitable for a full year?
I think it's a symbolic milestone. Yes, they're looking at four consecutive quarters of profitability with many asterisks, but that's done with an enormous amount of capital investment. I think on a free cash flow basis, they in the quarter, the first quarter, they were negative $900 million. But there are other parts of this story. Is China turning the corner? That could be the icing on top of it. If you're getting evidence in the United States that their order backlog is great, that they might hit their 500,000 vehicle mark at the end of the year, then those are things, especially in contrast with everything else that's not going right for GM and Toyota and the industrials, is why people are piling into the story.
Now, just yesterday, the company scrapped plans for a more affordable car, the Model Y. What is going on there?
I mean, it can scrap plans. I mean, now that the lowest price Model Y is going to start at $50,000, and the standard range version would have started at just under $40,000. But Elon Musk tweeted that it was canceling plans for this less expensive version because something at less than 250 miles at this point would be an unacceptably low standard range for them, that they're trying to up the bar. And that they can. Look, these are hot cars. And if you have a backlog of orders for the Model Y, why sell it, to kind of a scrapped model?
Even so, Robin, as you look around the world right now at the economy, you know, even if things are starting to get better in some places, it's nowhere near what we would have said several months ago. Does this feel like an overvaluation of Tesla?
This is a meaning of life question right now, Jeremy. I mean, let's step back. Our investors may be overvaluing the NASDAQ at near 10,500 while the economy is in the tank. I'm reminded of Amazon in 1999, when you well could have predicted that it would have become a retailing colossus in 10 or 20 years. Even so, it collapsed in the dot-com blow-up, losing 90% of its value in mm-hmm. 2 years. So this company is suddenly worth $300 billion. Be careful where you tread.
Existential question, which came first, the car or the battery? Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer signed an executive order this month requiring healthcare workers undergo implicit bias training to obtain or renew their medical licenses. Over the years, we've been learning how implicit bias targets Black people at all levels of society, from healthcare to schools and policing. And it doesn't matter the race of a person, we all carry the biases of the society in which we live. Joining us is Jennifer Eberhardt. She's a Stanford psychologist who has done a multi-year exploration of policing in America. Her research found the association between Black Americans and crime is so powerful that just thinking about violent crime can lead people to focus their attention on Black faces. Jennifer Eberhardt, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So Jennifer, playwright and TV writer Cynthia Franks wrote a story recently about how she, as a white woman living in rural Michigan, had been pulled over 5 times by police. She believes they mistook her large Black poodle for a Black man. And since her Black poodle died, she says she's not been pulled over once. Now, this sounds so ridiculous, but you say in your recent TED Talk this month that this is exactly how bias works. You even shared a story about your own son on an airplane.
Well, when my son was just 5 years old, we were on an airplane together. He was excited about being on the plane, and he's looking around and checking people out, checking everything out, and he sees a man, and he says, "Hey, that man looks like Daddy." And I look at the man, and I realize he was the only Black man on the plane. And so I'm all set to have a talk with my son about how not all Black people look alike. But before I could, my son looks at me and he says, "I hope that man doesn't rob the plane." And so I was just shocked at this. He's 5 years old, and already he has, absorbed this association between Blackness and criminality.
Mm-hmm. I find this so fascinating because even in our profession, in journalism, we will report details of a police-involved shooting and add the detail that lists the race of the person. For instance, like a Right. white officer, a Black officer. But what I'm hearing is that we carry the biases of the environment which we are part of. So for police, they can hold these biases of law enforcement at large.
Yes, they can. So let me give you an example. I met an officer once in a police department in a large urban area, and he had moved to the U.S. from Germany. Now, this officer had not, you know, thought much about race before he got here, but just after a few years of being a cop, this had altered his way of thinking. And when he was on patrol, Black men would draw his attention. He would look for their hands and he would look at how they moved their bodies, and he was ready to see threats even when none existed. So this is an example of how easily biases can form from, you know, the environment. So if we want to change our biases, we have to work to change the environment that is producing it.
Can you take on something else, though? I'm thinking about how reporting on disparity works, because oftentimes, though, when people hear over and over that there is a disparity, that perhaps more Black people are targeted by police, they believe that inherently, there must be something that Black people are doing to be the focus of police. That what you're finding is, all things being equal, there is a targeting of Black people. I guess I'm saying it and you're not saying it, Dr. Eberhardt.
Right,
but I
right.
want to speak to this, because right now we are at a moment where we are having discussions about disparities across the board in our society. And there's so many numbers that are coming up, but we're not talking about in the context of all things being equal.
Right. So if you look at, when police departments collect data on stops and searches and arrests and so forth, and you run the numbers, and what we find is, over and above the crime rate, that you still have this disparity, or you still have this overrepresentation of Black people in terms of their stops and searches and so forth. So that's what we, you know, typically think about as bias. And that's the thing that we want to address.
Mm-hmm. We saw what happened to George Floyd because it was recorded on a cell phone. But you say there are tools being used right now that we can analyze. With a team at Stanford, you've begun to use machine learning techniques to analyze large number of police encounters. What have you begun to find?
Yeah, so in Oakland, California, we have begun to look at body-worn camera footage, and we started with traffic stops. So we took nearly 1,000 traffic stops, and we were interested in looking at how officers spoke to Black versus white drivers during those stops. And we found that even when officers were behaving professionally, they spoke to Black drivers with less respect than white drivers.
Mm-hmm. You work with several police agencies. Have you been able to share the data with them so far? And what has been the response?
Well, yes. And so in Oakland, when we shared this data, they invited us to, help them to develop a training module around the traffic stop, where we gave them the takeaways of our study. And what we're doing now is looking at, footage of officers before that training and after that training to see if the training actually made a difference to real interactions on the street.
Hmm. Your research gives us the data that we need to make these informed decisions, but there is pushback that there's not much scientific evidence out there that shows implicit bias training works. What do you say to that?
Well, I agree with that. I think that we not only, when departments decide that they are going to, offer these trainings, that we should evaluate them. And for the most part, they are not being evaluated. So we need a lot more information about this, especially when it comes to, these implicit bias trainings.
In your talk, you talk quite a bit about the value of slowing down. You gave the example of prompts in the app Nextdoor, which uses a way to get people to be specific in reporting unusual activity, that it's not enough to say, I see a Black man.
Right.
Say more about the value of friction, as you call it, as a way to combat bias.
Yeah, well, so bias actually is more likely to get triggered in situations where we have to think quickly. In Oakland, in California, the police department changed the foot pursuit policy. It used to be the case that officers could chase a suspect on foot wherever that suspect went. And so if they lost sight of them, they could keep pursuing them. But then the department changed the foot pursuit policy so that if the officer lost sight of a suspect, they could not continue to follow them. They had to step back and set up a perimeter. If we shift a policy, there's a way in which we can decrease bias and have better outcomes.
Is this your advice as we look at all different sectors of society, the first step to take? What would you recommend to institutions as we all are now rethinking and assessing culture within organizations?
Well, I think that people don't always understand that systemic bias can feed personal bias. And so this is why simply screening people out who are biased during the hiring process won't work as effectively, you know, as people might think it would. Despite our goals and desires, the systems that we work in can begin to change who we are and how we behave. And so it takes real vigilance. It takes real effort to prevent that from happening.
Hmm. That's an even larger problem to take on, like an entire organization rethinking its system. I guess my question to you is then, as individuals within organizations are rethinking culture and how to shape culture, how do they take on something so large like the system? Say if it's a company or organization rethinking and taking this moment to take stock.
They can look at, the outcomes that are not desirable. So to the extent that they see racial disparities in hiring or promotions or in the C-suite or wherever it is, that they can, you know, examine, when those disparities come up and how and sort of what are some approaches they could use to address it. Just changing certain aspects of that environment can sort of change the mindset of people who are in that environment. It can, change the probability that those people will act on bias, where bias will influence their decision making and so forth.
That's Jennifer Eberhardt, psychologist at Stanford University and author of Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do. Thank you so much for this.
Oh, thank you.
After many months of pressure from the U.S., the United Kingdom announced today it will ban Huawei from its 5G networks. The move comes at a moment of growing wariness in the West over Chinese companies and their ties to the Chinese government. TikTok, the Chinese-owned video app with more than 2 billion downloads, is also being pulled into the fray, with Wells Fargo this week ordering its employees to delete the app off of all company devices. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is reportedly considering an all-out ban on TikTok. For more, let's bring in Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So this seems to be moving pretty rapidly. Just a few weeks ago, India announced a ban on TikTok and nearly 60 other Chinese apps. Now Peter Navarro and Mike Pompeo suggesting the U.S. could follow suit. Just remind us what's going on here.
Well, so I think the simple answer is that TikTok represents one of the first times a social media app with millions and millions of users in the U.S. has its origins in China. In the U.S. alone, about 170 million installs on devices here. And like all Chinese tech, TikTok at least has the appearance of having to work with the Chinese Communist Party. Now, of course, it is true that Facebook has to answer to the U.S. government, just like a company in China would have to answer to the Chinese government. But we tend to have some dubious views about the differences there, the anti-democratic behaviors of the government in China.
Well, and what about the security concerns for Americans? Because that's one of the things that Peter Navarro has been talking about, that the Chinese are getting access through TikTok to a lot of information about users. That's what he says from TikTok.
Yeah, so I think there are some concerns. TikTok pulls data on users just like a ton of social media apps. But there are some differences here. Number one, the Chinese government has passed laws that make it quite easy to force TikTok and really any app there to hand over user data. TikTok also snoops on your clipboard in a way that could be described as somewhat unique from other apps. An example of an issue where you'd be logging into a service, for instance, and you'd kind of like copy and paste your password. And TikTok can reportedly read some of that information when you store it on your clipboard. It's not the only app that does this, but it's probably the most popular app that does this. And it's a bit theoretical, maybe, but you can imagine a scenario where the Chinese government forces TikTok to hand over a bunch of passwords and other sensitive data on U.S. citizens, and then could use that for a state-sponsored attack of some kind.
TikTok is currently run by former Disney executive American Kevin Mayer, who has said that TikTok has never provided user data to the Chinese government, nor would it do so if asked. But the question is, can TikTok really avoid the reach of the Chinese Communist Party, even if it wanted to?
So this is a tricky one to answer right now. In recent years, there's been a lot of discussion about the idea of where all of this kind of data is physically stored. The idea being that if TikTok decides to store U.S. citizens' data on U.S. soil, those server farms will be under the jurisdiction of our government, so it wouldn't be an issue, potentially. TikTok has also done a lot of PR work to show that it is independent. But I think there are a lot of questions about where the rubber hits the road here. And that's why, for instance, you see the Defense Department saying that the TikTok app can't be installed on phones for members of the military.
Now, obviously, the users of TikTok aren't that scared because they're still using it, especially the American teenage users of TikTok. How are they reacting to the possibility of a U.S. ban?
Yeah, well, they may be using it, but they're using it, at least in this moment, in some ways to say how upset they are about a potential ban. A lot of users who have built huge followings on the app, some of whom who have made also a lot of money on the app, are making content talking about how upset they are. There have been hashtags asking people to push back against an anticipated ban in the U.S. And this is the trouble, right, with building your brand on a tech platform you can't really control. So it could have a big impact on TikTok's biggest users for sure.
You know, Ben, you and I have talked about TikTok before. We've also talked about Huawei, another Chinese company that the U.S. Does not want anything to do with at this moment.
Right.
Is this the beginning of a new Cold War, do you think, between the U.S. and China when it comes just to technology?
It's a good question. I mean, it's important to remember that what we're seeing right now isn't as much a beginning of something as it is a continuation of something that has been happening in China for years, right? We've watched U.S. tech giants like Google and Facebook do these policy acrobatics to try to get access to China's massive user base while still being able to claim that as companies, they're committed to democracy. And now China is catching up to us in the big tech race with companies that are building technology that people here want to use. And the reach of new Chinese technology is, I think, going to be a fact of life for everyone. But I think for some people, that's an argument not to be scared of foreign companies or foreign apps, for instance, but to instead look at ourselves and how we get better at protecting users and user data here at home in a way that sort of fits the democratic ideals that we love to talk about.
I will say, full disclosure, I am not a TikTok user. And I did laugh when I saw a meme the other day that said 30-somethings discussing TikTok, and it showed a picture of the Golden Girls sitting around the table talking about something.
It does feel that way sometimes, doesn't it? It does feel that way.
It does indeed. But, yeah. Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here Now, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Any excuse to play the Golden Girls. Here Now, a production of NPR and WVUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.